We have, I guess, several packages of material before us. Let's just take a moment to identify what we've got, and then we'll proceed, I guess, with a discussion of some of those items. Representative Phillips?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To facilitate discussion, Representative Dix and I have presented to the committee and the council, and maybe there's a couple of copies so people in the audience, if they're interested, can look at them. They're identified as SB 323C-107, and you've got Phillips/Dix written on the top of the copies. And for procedure, just so we have something to work with, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the adoption of the amendments so titled.
Well, Representative Phillips, I'm going to ask you to hold that motion until we... I've just seen these, and I would prefer that we just walk through the amendments one at a time before we take any motions.
Okay, it'd be my intention, Mr. Chair, so that we could have it on the record, and then we would be more than happy to go through every section and every word of it, so that at least procedurally we've got it on the record. Because just speaking on the record here, we see Seal's proposals and others, and I personally think we could consider these things forever, and I'd rather just work with this document and move it.
Okay. You want to go ahead and start with an explanation here, section by section?
And I take it you have accepted my motion?
No.
Well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, may I comment just very briefly?
Certainly.
We have had a consistent policy both in full and sub of having motions made for purposes of discussion and then going on with the discussion, and often the motion is made before anyone has ever considered the issues involved. All in the world that does is effectively put it on the table. But I think with the time frame we're trying to meet, getting a motion on the table and moving through with that motion is important, and I would support Representative Phillips' desire to have the motion placed at this time.
That's so noted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
No, obviously, I'll defer to the chair's intention. I don't think there's been any consistent policy at all on this, at least on the committees that I've been on. And I do want a thorough discussion. My point is to having a thorough discussion. I've got a 26-page amendment here that isn't proofread, dated yesterday. And I really think that, and I know from talking to Representative Phillips that that this is important policy issues before the state. I think it's window dressing one way or the other as to the procedural posture. I just wish we could get on with it and not make a big thing out of it. I think the power is in the chair's possession, and we should get on with the discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dix.
I see no purpose in discussing the Seals amendments if there's no motion on the table, and the intention is to put a motion on the table so that we discuss the Phillips-Dix amendments. I have no interest in walking through the Seals amendments if no one's going to make a motion to move them. And I don't know if that's the interest in making the motion on these amendments. If the intention, I would like a clarification, is the intention of the chair to walk through all the amendments that are before us before you accept a motion?
No. The chair's desire is to understand what it is that's in the -107 amendments before we accept any motions on that amendment. If there's no discussion offered on any other amendments, then obviously there's not going to be a motion on those amendments and no discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I just inquire quickly? What is the harm of considering the amendments under a motion placed?
I guess I'm not sure what the benefit is, let's put it that way. And I would rather, before I accept a motion on something I haven't even looked at and was just presented to this committee, I would prefer that we just proceed with a review of the amendments that are being proposed section by section, and then we'll take the motion as appropriate. So we can talk about this for the rest of the afternoon, or we can proceed with a review of the amendments. Representative Phillips?
Okay.
Or Representative Dix, whoever wants to...
I will go through it, Mr. Chair.
under the caps.
But I will tell you this. I would hope that you will entertain a motion at some time today with regard to these, and that we can move through them in somewhat deliberate manner. Punitive damages is the first section. This has been drafted up so it will fit into the See and Gross bill, beginning on line 2. Council, although this is not, quote, proofread, we have been adopting things conceptually, and I'm sure if we're successful in the adoption, by the time it's engrossed in the bill, we can go through and take out the few selected typos. It's designed to fit right into 323, taking out the sections which may overlap. First section of the bill that you'll see before you deals with punitive damages. We have in the bill, as you'll read on line 11, provided for clear and convincing evidence. You'll read it further that we changed some of the language from the original bill with respect to the word malice and put in wanton reckless disregard. You'll notice on section 2 of the bill that we dealt with health practitioners as similarly done in 323C. You'll notice in section 3 of the bill that we portioned the amounts out similar to done in section 323C of the bill, half going to the criminal compensation award and half going to the prevailing party. Half going to the obviously would be prevailing party. Section 4.
What?
And I'll go through it and then we'll go back on this section, if that's okay. Section 4 requires a supplemental hearing before the same trier on an issue of punitive damages. And Section 4A is the section of the bill dealing with, and it was amendments labeled 74 that were previously presented before us and talked about by the professor that came in with regard to the Employee and Employer Act and what should be punitive versus not. That's quickly, and I'd be more than happy to go back over and
one other item. One other change in the bill is that this bill, 323C, does not allow for companies to insure for punitive damages, and given the testimony by a couple of the witnesses that in fact corporations would simply incorporate in other states where there wasn't this clause in their law, in our bill, or in these amendments, allow companies to insure for punitives.
And you will also notice on page 5 of the bill is the language on product liability punitive damages that was section 6 of the original 323C, and we kept that in total.
Okay, on those sections dealing with punitive damages, Representative Phillips, did you, and Representative Dix, did you have a chance to complete your explanation?
Yes, sir, I did.
Representative Hanlon?
Well, are you going to go through the entire thing, or is to go back over questions on this section now?
Well, I thought it'd be, it's up to the chair, but I thought it'd be easier to deal with it section by section.
Oh, okay.
Let's try to deal with it section by section.
So we're now through page 4?
Page 5 is the housekeeping.
It's the same language as original in the original bill, 323C, but it is in our drafts just so that people are aware of that.
So if we go to section 1, I better get out my original 323C. How is it delete... what part of this deletes the insurability of punitives?
If you put in the bill saying you cannot insure in the original bill, and then we don't have it in our drafts that you can insure.
Oh, I see. It deletes the entire first. Does this just gut the original bill?
That's correct.
Okay. The word malicious on line 13. And intentional and wanton and reckless, Representative Phillips. You said something about the language being changed there, and I guess from the original bill, and I misunderstood you.
Well, the word with malice was used previously, and I felt that was a term of copious quantities of litigation and was convinced by the testimony that we had that it needed to be changed. And I took counsel from both our counsel and legislative counsel with regard to that issue, Kathleen Bouffet specifically.
Under section 2, would that prohibit punitive damages to be claimed in a case where one of those licensed practitioners, in the course of their treatment of a patient, for instance, just to make a horror story, cut off the wrong leg on purpose?
Well, no, because the law is written, as we understand it, similar to the original bill, so that if you're operating a healthcare practitioner acting without, quote, wanton, willful disregard, and by normal process, and I'm certainly cutting off the wrong leg in the example in which you give, is total disregard.
Did you intentionally leave in the words without malice on page 2? Line 20.
I did not intentionally leave in those words, no. But since you're kind enough to point that out to me, I will be more than happy to accept a motion changing that so it's similar to the language on page 1.
You'll have to excuse me, I'm a little slow going through here, but just slow. Representative Phillips, on section 4A.
Just one moment if you want.
Page 3.
3, okay.
This is the one that I can find either malice or what, but if you change it here, it takes care of it.
Is that, how is that a change from the current law?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hammond, we had testimony before us, and again, it's in your packet under Section 74. And the issue, and the professor who testified raised the issue of, do you want to hold an employer for acts of an employee? And this would clarify that negligence standard.
Would this exempt from punitive damages claim any corporate employer, period? And the reason I ask that is the employer or managing agent of the employer authorized the doing in manner of the act of the employee. Is this meant, if you got a corporate structure, you get off scot-free?
Absolutely not.
If there were a managing agent that knew certain employees were creating a hazardous, terribly hazardous situation on the job, but just looked the other way and let it continue, and some grievous damage came of it, is that the situation where punitive damages could be covered?
Yes, if you look at the definition on section 4A, punitive damages can't be properly awarded, and then go down to sub 2, talking about the employer managing of it was negligent, employing or retaining, and an example you have given me, I would certainly believe that would be negligence.
That the employer was negligent?
In your definition, you said he turned his head the other way.
Well, these people were performing on the job.
Okay.
Representative Phillips, I was wondering if you could help us out there on page 3, line 12, in terms of what the definition of unfit. Is that going to be something that the jury is going to have to determine, or the trier of fact?
I would assume the trier of fact, although I can research that and certainly get you a better answer, full committee.
Representative Phillips, was this language picked up from any other states, or...
I don't know if any other states have this language.
May I ask a question of counsel, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dix.
The Blair 74 amendments are filed with a Stroud versus Denny's restaurant case.
I believe so.
Was that, do you know if the amendments were drafted from that particular case?
I think they're from the Restatement of Torts, as reflected in a reference from that case.
Okay. Representative Phillips, I guess my question would be, what testimony or evidence was there that punitive damages, based upon what's happening here in Oregon, have contributed to what's been called a crisis in insurance? And I guess I place that question in the context of a study that was prepared for our information by Willamette University, and a follow-up study, the Stanford study done by Professor Hand. I think the conclusions of both were that punitive damages are awarded only infrequently, and that the awards, when they are significant, have taken place only when there's been a severe injury. Is there anything you want to point to or identify that establishes some relationship between insurance rates and what's going on in Oregon and what these amendments would accomplish?
Well, Mr. Chair, your analysis and my analysis of all the testimony that was presented before us might lead us to arrive at different conclusions. I will tell you that I support the concept of punitive damages, and in fact that's why when we drafted up the bill we didn't try and tie punitive to compensatory damages. Representative Brunn's statements when the testimony was presented on that were certainly convincing for me. I don't wish to, frankly, go through every section in every word of the bill and relate it to a specific study. I think you have to look at it in total.
Representative Hamlin.
On the cap provision, we're on to that already, aren't we?
No.
Representative Dix would be happy, I'm sure, to lead off a discussion on that.
If there's no other... Skip that?
No, we have no intention of skipping that. We just were addressing the punitive damage language, and then the next section that we're going to take on is the economic, non-economic cap section.
Okay.
Representative Hamlin, were there any further questions on the sections 1 through 4 of the amendments, or 1 through 4A? Okay, if not, Representative Phillips or Representative Dix, did you want to review the sections relating to economic and non-economic damages?
The section on economic and non-economic damages has two major differences. With 323C is passed, it lowers the cap to $400,000 non-economic damages, and it provides an exemption section, which is graph 3 on page 4, where the cap does not apply to paraplegia, quadriplegia, majority loss of limbs, total blindness or third-degree burn suffered over 70% of the body. The rest of the language is pretty much taken out of 323C on these sections, which can be found on, starting with section 12 on page 3 of the original bill.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to take a great deal of the subcommittee's time, so I'll just indicate that I have some major concerns with that section and cannot support it in that form, but I'll let it go at that.
Section 5? Okay. Representative Dix or Representative Phillips, I guess, have you folks made any changes in the definition of economic or
no
future damages or non-economic damages?
I believe economic damages is exactly how it's written in 23C.
Chair.
Okay, Representative Hamlin.
In line 23 on page 3, as a reference to bodily injury, including emotional injury. And my question is, emotional injury something that both economic and non-economic damages can be awarded for?
Yeah, I'll be glad to feel that one if you'd like.
Uh-huh.
I thought you did an excellent job when this testimony was in and you brought up the issue of what is pain and what is suffering and whether there's a difference. And if you'll recall at that time and when the witnesses came in, I suggested that we're going to be triers of fact, we, the courts, on the definition of economic and non-economic, whether we went with the majority plan as laid out in 323C or we adopt that language in the future. I would suggest, however, that it depends on the presentation of the plaintiff's attorney and the defense laid up and how the trier of fact reviews it, and I would almost believe that there's going to be some slippage from court to court and ruling to ruling.
Does that mean that then that emotional injury could certainly, in some cases, from emotional injury, could follow economic damages? Is that what your response means, Representative
Yes.
Phillips?
I would view it as emotional being suffering. I, however, think the plaintiff's attorney would present their case and the defendant would issue his findings and we'd let a trier of fact determine it.
Mr. Chair, if I might just continue.
Representative Hanlon.
And I've been wrestling with this one a long time. I'd like you guys to take a shot at it. It says here, if you just cut off including in each of these, economic damages means objectively verifiable monetary issues. And that should be losses, I would have to guess. But anyway, on line 13 it says non-economic damages means subjective non-monetary losses. If you just cut off the including and read each of those.
Well,
what's the difference?
What's the difference in the two sections?
What's the difference between economic and non-economic? If you only read what each of them means up to the word including and lop off the rest of the sentence, you have two different statements meant to be two different definitions, and each of them merely follow on to give examples.
Well, I think the
is there any basic thing that you can say about what the difference is?
Yes, I think the operative words in this are objective, verifiable, and subjective, non-monetary. Those are the operative words. And that is a clear delineation between one versus the other.
No, it's really the difference between verifiable monetary and subjective non-monetary. I understand your response. And am I correct? There's an error on line 14. All right, an error on line 2.
Line 2, and I've noted it on page 4, line 2, change issues to losses.
On, Mr. Chair, if I may continue.
Rep. Sam Hanlon.
Would the proponents of this, either of you, be interested in looking over the replacement of the word paraplegia with the word paralysis? The reason I say that is it's my understanding in the medical field that paralysis would pertain to the brain and the brain stem and brain injury, and one could have a child or a baby injured in a birth injury case that would never sit up in this lifetime, that would neither qualify under the definition of paraplegia or quadriplegia, and therefore I'm just asking whether
Mr. Chair, Representative, your suggestions are well taken. Certainly we'll consider almost anything at any time, as the Chair is kind enough to let us consider our amendments. Representative Dix and I will indicate to the committee and the public that we plan to meet with Legislative Council and look specifically at these definitions and see whether we can tighten them up, loosen them up, change them to effectively bring about the language that we want, and we'll have that in full committee for you. And I certainly am at least willing, you know, you asked me if I'm willing to look at it. When we debate that issue, you bet.
Well, let me put it more specifically then. Would it be the intent, if my example is accurate, that a baby with extreme brain damage were born with paralysis that didn't qualify for either paraplegia or quadriplegia and would never even sit up in this lifetime, would that be something that it was your intent to exempt, an injury that was your intent to exempt from the cap?
Let me try and address that. Jump in where you want. The intent of the cap as it's written is to try and alleviate the concerns and the perception that's developed that you must have a cap, at the same time trying to take into account descriptions of situations that you've described, Representative Hanlon. That the Representative Phillips and I plan, following subcommittee, to sit down. There are things that are left out that I think should be included. There are things perhaps Representative Phillips feels the same way about. We also both feel that there's some tightening that can be done on the definitions. So I guess in answer to your question, the purpose in writing it was to try and exclude those who really would need exemption under the cap, the truly needy, but at the same time not throw the baby out with the bathwater in writing this legislation. That's a poor analogy given the situation.
That took my example into consideration.
Excuse me?
Your comment about throwing the baby out took my example into consideration.
Well, it's one I've used frequently, and given your description, the purpose in designing the cap is to remove those who are the most needy, who I think a majority, hopefully, of the committee will agree, should be exempt under the cap in the situation we've described, in my opinion, falls underneath. How we describe that in the cap is something we have to work out with council.
Representative Dunn.
I just point out that Representative Hanlon's question raises one of the concerns I have with the cap, because paralysis not only accurately reflects the concern that Representative Hanlon has, but brings in an entire new group much beyond what he described. There are all kinds of paralysis of all parts of the body, not just arms, legs, and raises the very concern that I have with struggling for an exception. And I would just point out that I think all of the committee members want to ultimately arrive at a situation where we adequately compensate victims and at the same time solve the problem of those small business victims that we have out there. And there may be other ways ultimately, besides an exception, to arrive at that goal.
Okay. Representative Hanlon.
If I might just go forward a bit, I have a question on what majority loss of limbs means.
That's one of the other problem areas that in discussions I've had a hard time defining myself and one we're going to take back to council. Majority, when you have four limbs, would constitute, I guess, 2.1% loss of your four limbs. The purpose in the way it was written originally was if you have lost an arm and a leg, but you're not considered a paraplegic or a quadriplegic, you should fall outside the cap as well. As one of the witnesses who testified here had lost an arm and a leg, but she could walk and had, with the use of a prosthesis, pretty much both uses of both limbs in some fashion, but obviously, given the damage to her body, in our opinion, should Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about form and style, perhaps we can get Kathleen up here. The intent was, I think Representative Phillips outlined the intent, but I'll be glad to, if you want to wait 3 minutes to get Kathleen up here.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we just note the inconsistency in those two and really ask counsel to conform them in the most legally appropriate way, and if any member feels that conforming went the wrong direction, we can move the other.
Thank you, Representative Bond.
You'd not want me to bring up anything that I see that's wrong? Is that it?
No, not at all. I just can't answer questions in form and style. In fact, I'm happy, Representative Hanlon, that you are bringing this stuff up. That's why we're going through this.
And
you're serving a real service by doing it.
The issues you've raised, we said we're
circling and moving on. It's just hard to answer questions of form and style, and we didn't actually put those into form and style ourselves.
For whatever value it has, and they have none, that language, whatever the explanation is, appears to track the language that the Senate adopted, and why they chose to handle it one way and not the other certainly is anybody's guess, but I appreciate the fact that there will be some follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me gripe a little. This is the first time this session that we've gone over the tort language. We've talked about the general philosophies. It's the first time in this committee that we've addressed the language, be it in the original printed bill or in the amendments as presented today.
Okay, are there further questions about the joint and several liability, Section 7 of the -107 amendments?
Are we going to be discussing along the way the philosophy behind this?
If you wish to, Representative Hanlon, or any members, I think, free to raise whatever issue they wish in discussion.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bond.
We have a real tightrope to walk, and I guess I would comment on that. We have a goal to move this out of subcommittee swiftly. It's been made clear that we'll deal with this again and the policy issues again in full committee.
And
we could literally spend 2 weeks dealing with the philosophy behind the issues. So I guess that I would encourage the chair to allow us to move through the bill as much as possible without getting into lengthy discussions on the policy matters involved, and to reserve those more fully for full committee.
Okay. Any further discussion of Section 7? Okay, if not, Section 8, relating to contingent fees.
Council, can you tell me what section of the original bill this was out? I can't find it.
You're talking about the joint and several?
No, contingent fees.
Yeah, just a second. It's a short little paragraph.
Try section 12.
12.
What we did is expanded section 12 and section 8. And the thrust is to make sure that the plaintiff understands the agreement he or she is signing with the attorney.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bunn.
I will say very quickly again, I have objections to Section 8. I will deal with those in full committee, but I just want to express them very briefly. The entire testimony we heard before this committee was complimentary of the work attorneys have done. I cannot recall a single complaint where there was a need to back out of an agreement with an attorney, a single complaint about attorneys ripping off their clients. I realize this is a very popular issue with the public, to get the attorneys because somehow they're rip-off artists. I see no need for the 24-hour back-out provision in the contingency fee agreement, no need for the provision that says you can only charge on a certain portion of the work done. And so in full committee, it will be my desire to simply attempt to require a clear written agreement and allow the attorney and client to get on with their private contract.
Thank you, Representative Munn.
Those objections are not.
Okay. Any provisions as it relates to the attorney fee provisions that protect the defendants?
Mr. Chair.
Some of the testimony we heard were that the defense fees were often as great, if not a greater, concern.
Well, they're not usually on a contingency fee basis.
Yes.
So that's why they weren't addressed under contingent fees. That was my understanding of the testimony, that it's per hour flat rate. It's not whether they win or lose.
And of course, defense is just that. If you don't get sued in the first time place, you don't have to go out and get a, quote, defense. So,
well, rather than entertain this argument.
Yeah.
The reason why it's not under contingent fees is because those cases aren't taken on a contingency basis.
Question.
Let's name one.
Well, this says that the agreement shall apply only to any increase in the settlement or a greater judgment than the settlement offer. What does that mean?
Can you tell me the line again, Corey?
Yeah, it says on page 7, lines 21 and 22.
I'd be glad to address that if you like. Specifically, if you represented a client, the client had previously received a settlement offer of $30,000. Your work on behalf of that client got an additional $5,000, that your fee agreement would apply only to the additional $5,000, not to the whole $35,000.
What was the specific abuse that led to that provision or the testimony?
Many of the issues that are raised by both defense and counsel in general. You talked not 5 minutes ago about philosophy. Perhaps philosophical belief would be the best.
And this is a settlement offer that has taken place prior to the contingent fee agreement?
That's correct.
Does that have to be in writing, or would that be verbal? Or
I will certainly, when it comes to full committee, have an amendment saying written, because that was suggested.
Okay, any further discussion on Section 8?
I have an idea for this section.
Okay, Section 9?
Part of it's not up.
Collateral sources.
It's all yours.
Collateral source addresses the issue of, just what it states. It says that the judge may
nutshell, but may, when a verdict or settlement is reached, review other items providing benefits to the person. We exempt in collateral source, life insurance benefits, federal social security benefits, retirement or pension plan benefits. And that explains the section.
Question, Mr. Chair.
This is a new section to the bill.
Representative Hamlin.
Would this you said did not include insurance benefits, federal social security, retirement, or pension plan benefits. It doesn't refer to either Medicare or Medicaid. Where would that be in here? Those are two major sources of health care payments that are paid, one being the state payments and one being federal payments. Would those be excluded from what's to be considered?
No, they're included, and it means health insurance benefits. It is mentioned in there. If you would like it specifically delineated, we can talk to council as to whether that is needed.
Representative Bunn.
When you're talking about federal Social Security benefits, are you meaning their Social Security retirement benefits or many other reimbursement programs?
Well, and this was brought to my attention previously, and in checking the Social Security, many of those programs have been cut out under this administration. The programs that are left are not programs that I want to include as a collateral source for the judge to review.
Perhaps I could word it just slightly differently. By pulling in other disability benefits and defining health insurance and collateral source, I felt that was broad enough, and under federal Social Security is to delineate everything out that is included within, including anything included under Social Security.
I would be happy to provide full committee with a list of Social Security programs.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Apparently, on line three, the court, in its discretion, what guidelines, if any, are the criteria to guide the court in the exercise of its discretion in this area?
The court will have just heard all the issues before it, and will be able to make its judgment depending upon those issues and the other affidavits filed before it with regard to collateral source.
How do you handle the payment of attorney's fees? Does that have to be deducted, or I'm sorry, I'm confusing that with another issue, but let me ask, is that something, the attorney's fees, if it's a percentage of the award and the award is then reduced, does that mean that the attorney's fee is based on the first amount originally awarded or on the amount that the deductions have been taken from? I guess would be my question.
The way that I visualize this happening is that you've got a decision rendered, a judgment ordered, the court then may review all those. Depending on what deductions it would choose to make, then the plaintiff would get X sum of money, of which then they have had agreement with an attorney, and that then it would be apportioned out.
I guess also on line three, when you talk about the amount or value, are you anticipating, say if a person had a collateral source which promised to pay a certain amount if they had a disability or what have you, say that was provided by the employer, I think all of us have some employer paid disability benefits.
how would that be treated? That's a benefit that apparently there's been no payment by the employee as such, although there may have been a reduction in wages, or the employee may have accepted a lesser wage for that benefit, but the employee has not paid for that benefit. How would that be treated?
First of all, your premise that most of us, and you're correct when you refer to most of us, I'm sure we do have a disability benefit. However, when you make that premise regarding the general public, I'm not sure it's as accurate or can hold up. That's why we left the flexibility for the court to judge value. That's why we put in retirement or pension plans, because depending on what type of a disability program you're under, it may be a permanent retirement program. Those are things that have to be evaluated.
But this allows the court discretion. It's written broadly enough so that the court has discretion to look at insurance benefits that are lost, compensation that is given up, for instance, for employer-provided benefits in exchange for a raise, perhaps at some bargaining session. They might have gotten disability insurance, and I think that can be brought to the judge's attention in the way this is written.
When we try to estimate the value, I'm not sure that that's something that a court in and of itself is particularly qualified to do. Do you anticipate that the plaintiff or defendant or both would be bringing in expert witness, economists, what have you, to advise the court or to state their opinion and for the court to determine?
Well, just knowing the process, it would be by affidavit, probably by the defense attorney, and that material would be prepared for the judge to make a ruling upon.
Is it your intent that the jury be advised of any of this?
No.
So there'd be no the collateral source rule. To the extent that the jury is told nothing about collateral sources, is it your intent that that would remain on the books?
That's correct.
And should that be... I don't know if there's any additional drafting that has to be done to accomplish that, but I would appreciate it if you would research that also.
You bet.
Representative Hanlon.
Representative Dix Phillips, on this collateral source, if I'm a plaintiff in court and I have Blue Cross health insurance and I apply to Blue Cross and I've signed an agreement with them saying if I recover anything in a court of law, then you'll get paid back for anything that has been paid out on my behalf. Now, it's my understanding that's a common agreement. You never get by without Blue Cross doing that. Is it your intent, when this comes up in court, not only to put the amount that Blue Cross paid before the judge, but also to allow me to introduce evidence that I have to repay out of those pre-proceeds this amount? The whole body, see, it says here, may be deducted by the court, but the question then is how
it's our intent that you would be allowed in that situation to not only bring the amount you're going to receive, but also the fact or contract that you sign saying that you have to repay that amount as soon as you get that award.
And may I follow up?
Would
it be your intent in that situation then that the judge allow me credit for that if I'm obligated to pay it back already and present that evidence?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it might be helpful to have legislative counsel draft language that provides that subrogated amounts like that would be handled as Representative Hanlon outlined.
Okay. Any further questions on the collateral source section? Okay, if not, the next section relates to criminal conduct.
Okay, I'll be right with you. Mr. Chair, in the original bill as passed 323-C, the
specific language referring to felonies was A and B, and we added in C felonies. That is the most substantive change before you today.
Okay. Any folks recall what testimony would we have that
we need to allow
felons are recovering in Oregon courts, or that this is a problem? Or?
Mr. Chair, I'll refer that to a philosophical belief of the drafters of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Clerk St. Bond.
I would just suggest that I would hope that drafters of these amendments would keep open in full committee to considering whether Class C felons that are drivers and that their felony is driving while suspended and those things be considered in full committee, whether or not we really want to eliminate their right.
That's come up, but I think that, and that's certainly open for discussion, but I think that the... And it's been suggested that 50,000 people a day in Oregon are driving while suspended, and that potentially is a real problem. But and it'll be open for discussion, but I think at some point there's a philosophy that if people are driving while suspended, they're breaking the law.
I want you to know, Representative Bunn, this is the most liberal approach to this issue I really I'm more on the entertaining, although I will listen to your arguments.
Thank you.
This represents a compromise, Representative Gunn.
You can a severe compromise.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Would the person damaged have to be the person committing the crime?
Excuse me?
Would the person damaged have to be the person committing the crime? The language says the person damaged was engaged in conduct at the time. And my question was, would the person damaged have to be the person committing the crime?
No.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it's
my understanding that the original language in the bill would have required or at least intended that you at least be convicted of the crime. If you were found not guilty, you would be exonerated. Would you consider, how do I say this? A person may be driving, potentially engaged in conduct, but there's no court that's litigated that. Is that the point you're making?
No, that was my next question.
Okay.
But you go ahead on that one.
Well, and I would just hope that at minimum in full committee we could clean that language up to say you have to at least have been convicted.
I am not unamenable if that's such a word.
Convicted of murder and aggravated murder as well?
Well, no, the point that is being made is that if you're driving down the highway and the argument is made that you are carrying out conduct that would constitute a crime, that being driving while felony suspended, there's no requirement here that a court convict you of that. And that raises the question, could the other party merely raise in their pleadings that you had carried out that conduct? Or does there need to be a conviction on the record or at least a court process occurring?
I will put it to you this way. I am willing to consider amendments that you might draft up and bring in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
It gets back to my original question, though, Paul, which I think is a separate question. Does the person damaged have to be the person committing the crime? However you define it, whether you require a conviction or whether you require that it be proven by the defendant in court.
Representative Hanlon, let me try.
Can you state it better? I really wish it.
But our criminal law may hold a person somewhat liable or culpable as an accessory to certain kinds of conduct. A passenger who knows that the person is driving while suspended could be injured, would that person be deemed to be barred from recovery if that passenger were injured?
I will say preliminarily no. However, I will research the point and find out specifically the way that's written. The way I believe, if you want to get into philosophies, if he knew and he's culpable, I would approach it differently and more conservatively than most, I think.
Okay, Representative Phillips, let me try another hypothetical. Class C felony includes commercial burglary, as you may or may not know. If a merchant were to rig a trap gun or a spring gun, which killed or caused serious injury to an individual who may be engaged in conduct which would amount to an attempt or a commercial burglary, is that the kind of action that you would want to foreclose as well?
Breaking the law.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Let me just take it a bit further. There are some college kids that probably had a bit too much to drink that see the farmer's pigs penned up, and not knowing that the fence is wired to have anybody that touches it be shot with a shotgun. And they say, oh boy, let's go get them pigs. And consequently, one of them is killed. Is that the kind of thing that you would intend to bar any claim?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hammond, if you ask my philosophical approach to this, and you disagree with it, you're free in full committee, saying that this passes to full committee, to bring up those issues and offer amendments. I take an extremely conservative approach to those breaking the law. I will tell you, however, on the other issues you've raised, I'm willing to draft up the amendments and get them done. If this is an issue to you, I would ask or request respectfully that either you or Representative Bunn bring them in, because it's not an issue that I want to be involved in, but I will look at them.
Let's ask philosophically, Representative Phillips, you want to take this decision away from the jury then?
Well, again, Mr. Chair, we can discuss ad infinitum.
I haven't heard any testimony that juries in this state have brought awards for felons or convicted felons. Maybe you have evidence that's taken place. Your philosophical premise seems to question whether or not juries in this state, based upon a common sense and experience, are going to be capable of making that kind of decision based upon the standards in this community or in this state. Is that part of your philosophical premise in taking that question or that issue away from the jury?
We as legislators, if we're successful in convincing both bodies and the committees in which we bring the issues up to stating what we believe the law ought to be, and the juries will therefore then abide by those laws.
Maybe this is an incorrect way to look at it given my supposed political perspective, but I have a problem with someone who robs a home and is wounded in the leg bringing suit against that individual who shot him in the leg, wounding him, or even killed him when he's robbing the house and has a history of robbery. You're forced as a person owning the home to hire counsel and defend yourself against the liability.
Are we aware of such a case in the state of Oregon?
If you have suggestions, I would leave the option up to you, Mr. Chair.
Solve a lot of problems that don't exist. I mean, it seems to me, philosophically.
Chair, the young gentleman to your left must have something to say to you.
Might be a call.
No, the speaker requests your presence.
The speaker has requested that Representative Phillips and I join her on the floor.
You take over the committee while you're running.
I will accept. I think Representative Hanlon might have an objection. Representative Hanlon, would you like to continue in our absence, or would you rather take a recess?
I think you better declare a recess.
I'd be glad to let him keep on going. I think you and I are debate, Mr. Secretary.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a question. I'm glad to keep going, but are we going to need to repeat any sessions for the chair?
I think it better be a recess.
Yeah. Why don't we take just a short recess, see how long we're going to be on the floor, see where we're at on the floor. It's about time for us for a recess in any event, so... We had concluded our discussion of Section 10, criminal conduct. If that's the case, I'd like to move on to Section 11. Representative Phillips, I understand you're going to renew your motion sometime before 6 p.m. I'd like to, if at all possible, make sure we're in a posture and had a chance to at least review the issues, although I understand some issues are going to be carried over till full committee, which if we can take action in subcommittee tonight on any motions, we would then take this up in full committee tomorrow. There are, I guess I would note, there are some additional amendments which I think council has prepared or is preparing. If we're going to move this to full committee, or if that's the intention tonight, this evening, I'd like to do so with the understanding that those amendments would not be foreclosed because we haven't had time this evening afternoon to discuss them, if that's the desire of the folks who are going to
be. Those amendments before us?
Well, some of them are before us that council prepared and set out. We also have a copy of the, at least to the best that we've got, the Hanning Gross version of the bill. Representative Bond.
I just clarify, what I understand you to be saying is that full committee will not be foreclosed from considering those amendments, is that
right? Right.
I have no problem with that.
Okay. Let's move on to Section 11, frivolous actions.
Okay. Frivolous actions, an important one to me. Let me get myself together here. Okay. Section 1 deals with the claim for wrongful use of civil process. Similar as the main bill. Section 2 gives a 30-day grace period with regard to filing an action if it's coming up against the statute of limitations. The issue that we wanted to get at is to allow individuals to file a counterclaim immediately upon what is thought to be a wrongful use of civil process. If you go to page 10, it talks about the process within the act and